And this is KPCW. Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's 8:06 on this Wednesday morning, July 22nd. Currently 65 degrees here in Old Town Park City under cloudy skies. We've got 68 degrees in Heber City, also under overcast skies. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, it's meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Happy Wednesday, KPCW listeners. It's time for your forecast for the Wasatch back on this Wednesday. As we take a look at your forecast, we're looking at another chance of scattered showers and thunderstorms developing into the afternoon, producing some torrential downpours, frequent lightning, and the chance of some isolated gusty winds. Temperatures, because of the extra clouds and the scattered showers and storms today, will only warm into the lower 80s in Park City. We'll see those high temperatures only in the upper 80s to near 90 in the Heber Valley. Now, as we go into tonight, we could still have a couple of those scattered showers lingering into the evening hours before fading out. Otherwise, look for partly cloudy skies as we go into your Thursday. There will still be a chance of a few isolated showers and thunderstorms by Thursday afternoon, but the coverage will be much less than what we were dealing with for us as we go throughout your Wednesday afternoon. High temperatures will climb into the mid-80s for us in Park City on your Thursday afternoon, with highs around 90 degrees in the Heber Valley. As we move into your Friday, all-important Pioneer Day, right now we've got mostly sunny to partly sunny skies expected for you. It's overall looking mainly dry, which is great news. Temperatures will be a little warmer as well. High temperatures will climb into the upper 80s near 90 in Park City. We'll see those highs jumping into the mid-90s in the Heber Valley. As we move into the upcoming weekend, yeah, as we dry things out, we're going to heat things back up. So we'll see those high temperatures for your Saturday and Sunday warming up to around 90 degrees in Park City. We'll have those high temperatures warming into the mid-90s for your Saturday and Sunday across portions of the Heber Valley. Now, there will be a very slim chance of an isolated shower, but I'm keeping it as a very slight chance right now. We'll fine-tune that as we get closer, but don't be surprised if a shower pops up on your Saturday afternoon, but not a big deal. Otherwise, heading into next week, mainly dry with partly cloudy skies. Temperatures will remain in the upper 80s near 90 in Park City, and we'll keep those high temperatures in the mid-90s for everyone in the Heber Valley. That's the latest on your forecast for the Wasatch Back on ABC4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be checking in with Summit Rising Program Manager Ford Huntington, along with Interim Executive Director of the Song Summit, Paige Anderson. We'll be talking about this year's festival and some of the programs that the foundation offers. Utah Main Street Manager and State Coordinator Chelsea Gauthier and Historic Park City Alliance Director Ginger Wicks calling in with details on the expansion of this network, which includes Park City and Midway's Main Streets. And two-time world record holder Jen Drummond on her historic accomplishment is joined by her son, Jacob Hokanson, who climbed her final mountain, Denali, with her. Then stay tuned for the Mountain Life. Today's guests include Rebecca Brenner, co-founder of Mindful Summit County, and working with Summit Pride, talks about her recent book, Paper House, a memoir in verse that arose after discovering a long hidden box of her late mother's poems and journals. Then, as part of their new second act series, they'll speak with Rick Nemiroff, founder of Chomp Donuts, about what led him to open a donut shop after a very prominent career as a trial attorney. All of that coming up on the Mountain Life, heard, of course, every Wednesday from 9 to 10. The Wasatch Back is at risk for flash floods through Friday, along with the rest of the state. KPCW's Christine Weller has more on how to stay safe.
The Beehive State is at risk of flash flooding through Pioneer Day, according to the National Weather Service. Meteorologist Alex DeSmet said there has been flash flood activity since last week, but more monsoonal moisture has increased the risk level.
We typically see flash flooding from monsoonal thunderstorms over normally dry washes, lick rock areas, poor drainage areas, and burn scars.
Flash flooding has been reported on burn scars, including in Wasatch County, where the Yellow Lake Fire burned over 33,000 acres in the winter of 2024 to 2025. Burns from the over 97,000-acre Cottonwood Fire in Beaver and Paiute counties also flooded during monsoonal rains. According to the Utah Department of Transportation, flooding severely damaged or completely washed away Beaver's State Route 153 in several locations Sunday afternoon. The road is now closed indefinitely, and the city has declared a state of emergency. DeSmet said burns leave forests vulnerable.
Normally, the soil is kind of like a sponge. It's able to absorb water. But what happens is after a burn scar, particularly if the fire was of a high burn severity, it turns the soil into a substance that acts more like concrete.
DeSmet said flash flooding is also common near steep terrain. Highways through mountainous areas can become especially dangerous as floods can cause rock and landslides. To stay safe, DeSmet recommends locals check the forecast before recreating outdoors. DeSmet said it's also important to have a way to receive emergency alerts and to make sure a trusted person knows your location. A family of five was killed in a southern Utah flash flood July 17th. Another man died July 18th after being struck by lightning at the top of American Fork Twin Peaks.
If there's showers and thunderstorms in the forecast, then they should consider some alternate plans for the day, because in a thunderstorm, there is no safe place. The safest place to be is inside a sturdy shelter.
DeSmet said the monsoonal moisture in Utah right now is normal. However, the season this year may be extended and active through September, particularly in southern Utah. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
The Song Summit Foundation is a Park City-based nonprofit dedicated to transforming lives through music education and wellness. In the studio to tell us more, I have Ford Huntington. He's the program manager for Summit Rising, along with the interim director of the foundation, Paige Anderson. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning, Liza.
Paige, for those not familiar with the Song Summit Foundation, maybe tell us a little bit about the foundation's mission and why it was created.
Sure. My husband and I created the Song Summit Foundation because we found in the music industry that there was a lot of issues with mental health and wellness. And so part of what our pillars are is education and wellness for both artists and audience alike. And then we created this new program, the Summit Rising program, that helps emerging artists enter into the industry with good tools, mentorship, support, and performance opportunities, as well as some workshops for them to learn.
Okay, so again, this kind of grew out of the Song Summit Festival that's been going on.
Yes.
And I guess, how does it expand on the festival's focus of music, wellness, and community throughout the whole year?
It's been a really interesting journey for us, because this year we're doing something completely different than we have in the past, which is we, as the foundation, are putting on Song Summit Village, which is in Library Field, next to where the Song Summit Labs will take place in the Jim Santee Auditorium. So this is an unticketed space for our community to come and join together. So in Song Summit Village, we will have a fun run with celebrity chef Gregory Gourdet. We will do morning wellness, which will include yoga and meditation and breath work by KJ Ward of the Salt Lake's own Backseat Lovers. And then throughout the day, we will have our Summit Rising artists perform on a stage. And then we will have wellness vendors and other vendors throughout the village to help people on their wellness journeys, because everybody's wellness journey is different. And so we want to learn from each other. And so there'll be different tools there. Our 501c3s in town will be showcased, from, you know, Summit Clubhouse to, you know, the Arts Council. We'll have live painting there. We will have Plunge, which will have a bring a mobile sauna and cold plunge opportunity. We will have assisted stretch. So you'll be able to learn of a lot of different wellness journeys in the village. And that'll, so morning wellness is from 9 to 11, and the village will be open from 11 to 7. We'll also have some celebrity chef activations, because one of the things that we have also learned is the culinary arts are very much like the musical arts. And so the creatives, both in both industries, have challenges, as we all do, with mental health and wellness. So we found that incorporating culinary into this program in the village really made sense. So we'll have Sean Brock, who is a celebrity chef and very famous. He loves to spin vinyl. So he'll be spinning vinyl and cooking up some oysters for us, and tying in the very old vinyl of the New Orleans kind of community, and tie that in. And so, we will have various activations there, like a good old bake sale. Just like the old days that we had, we're going to have a good old bake sale with some of our celebrity chefs that are at Song Summit this year.
Okay, so the village is going to be open, what, like Friday, Saturday, Sunday?
Friday, Saturday.
Oh, Friday, Saturday. Okay. Mm-hmm. And talk to me a little bit more. I hadn't heard that. I mean, when you kind of lump in the culinary collective with, you know, music. I mean, that music is sex, drug, and rock and roll, right?
Yes.
I mean, but I mean, I wouldn't think that the same thing with chefs and the culinary industry.
Yes, there is a lot of challenges with addiction and things like that in the culinary industry. And so our food wizard, if you will, that organizes all of our culinary events at Song Summit is Andrew Zimmern, and he's been in recovery a long time. And he has organized our celebrity chefs this year, which are Gregory Gourdet, Damaris Phillips, and Stephanie Izard, and they're each going to have a dinner paired with one of the Song Summit artists. And then we will go dance at night at the marquee with their music.
Okay, so the dinners are a ticketed event.
A ticketed event through Song Summit.
All right, and so are there still tickets available?
There are still tickets available. And each of the dinners will take place at Le Depot.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Ford, as the program manager for the Summit Rising, talk to us a little bit about the program, who it's designed for, and you know, what your mission is here.
Yeah, so I came into the program last year. I was actually a part of the program as an artist in its inaugural year. And then this year, kind of coming into it, we wanted to, I guess, kind of revamp the whole thing. But it's a program designed for kind of artists in that middle ground between, you know, they've maybe started on their music path and they've begun to dip their toes into the music industry, but there's kind of a big bridge from starting to play music and starting to, you know, work in the industry to actually having a sustainable career in the industry. And I think that a lot of people, they get kind of lost in the middle there. And so we're kind of trying to be a good, you know, between those two worlds where we can give them, you know, kind of introductions to how, you know, processes run in the music industry, give them opportunities for mentorship and all these other things. And then also just the, like, for some of our younger artists, like, opportunities to, like, maybe play at a festival for the first time, understand how run of show goes with those things. And so, and then we also provide workshops and all of these other events that, with artists, like, main artists from the festival, that just kind of give them another, you know, another line on what it's like to exist in this space. Because I think the music industry is really unlike a lot of other industries where there's not a lot of consistency in how, you know, just how everything works. I mean, it's like if one thing worked for somebody, that's great, it worked for them, but it might not work for somebody else. And so to corral all the things that are consistencies, that are consistent processes, that are things that you can latch onto in kind of that sea of uncertainty relative, it's nice to have those things. And so we're trying to create an environment where we can give those things to people and provide that mentorship.
Yeah, and then talk a little bit about the wellness component, because as you say, I mean, with that inconsistency, that's kind of where the substances kind of become involved.
Totally. And I think that you know, especially with touring is probably the thing that is the biggest, it probably brings up a lot of those issues with, like, addiction and substance. And substance is so prevalent in the music industry in general. Like, it's probably one of the only industries in which it's, like, totally okay to just be on, like, be drinking on the job, be, you know, interacting with all these substances. It's not some huge taboo, and I think that lack of a line really can make it easy for people to kind of go off the end. And so I think providing not only all these wellness resources for the artists, but also maybe giving them connection with other artists who've maybe been through the ringer with that stuff, just provides context and maybe makes it so they're not going to make the same mistakes, or maybe they're going to just have more access. I think mental health is kind of the big component of this, and understanding, like, how to be a working musician and be in the industry and be, you know, touring specifically, and not, you can kind of lose yourself in that, I think, if you're not careful. And so if we can provide at least some guidance along the way, I think we're doing a big thing there.
Yeah. How many participants will you have in Summit Rising?
We'll have 10 Summit Rising artists this year. We had a huge flood of applicants this year, so I believe we had 70 applicants coming from as far as Uganda, which was, I think we're really excited about how far the reach got. But so we have artists coming from all over the U.S. And an artist or a band coming from Mexico as well. And yeah, we're just really excited about how much, I feel like, much broader of a reach we got this year.
Yeah. So what qualities do you look for in choosing an applicant?
Well, I think it's our program's kind of a specific thing where if you're too, you know, engrossed in the music industry, this might not be the most beneficial program. So we're looking for people who have maybe been successful in a local music scene or maybe a regional you know, touring circuit. But if we get much bigger than that, they're a little bit beyond our, you know, our capacities, I guess, for what we can provide them.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, kind of the established artists do mentorship for mm-hmm. So what does that look like?
It kind of comes about in a lot of different ways. One of the main things we're doing is, like, we have a couple workshops that are just for our Summer Rising artists, and those will be with some of the artists that are playing, you know, the main stage of the Marquee. And that looks like songwriting workshops, arranging workshops, you know, stuff that kind of gives them just like a sort of a common ground to come together with these artists. And then who knows kind of what unfolds from there. And I think kind of the magic of the program is figuring out how to create these spaces but not direct them too much, because you want to let, you know, these kind of natural connections unfold between, you know, all these different people along the line. And I think that'll even happen within, you know, you have obviously the dynamic between, like, our main artists and the Summer Rising artists, but then you even have that amongst the Summer Rising artists and the age range that you have there, like, where there's mentorship in friendship and camaraderie kind of in those situations. So it's about kind of just setting the stage and then letting everything else kind of take place. And so I think those workshops are a big dynamic. And then also just having all these different events, like, we have dinners that are going to be just for the artists, where they're going to, you know, get to just have community. And I think half of the battle with mental health in the music industry is finding community and having, like, a support group. And so I think we kind of provide that by just setting the stage.
So are there ages for the Summit Rising applicants? I mean, it's limited.
Yeah, we're trying to, this year it was 25 and under is kind of our age range. This year, obviously, with the Marquee, I guess we're kind of shooting for that, like, 21 to 25, because we want artists to be able to take full breath. I think we have one artist that's a little bit younger, but yeah, so kind of in that, you know, early 20s is I think the ideal age range.
Okay. Well, looking ahead to this year's Song Summit page, I mean, we've got the dates in August, right?
Yes, August 27th through the 29th.
Okay. And what are some of the highlights that people can expect this year?
Wow. This year we're having, like I said, 3 celebrity chef dinners at Le Depot, and they will be before the nighttime events at the Marquee. So Thursday night is Steve Poltz and Sierra Hall, and then Friday night is a very special acoustic set by Jim James of My Morning Jacket. And I had the opportunity to see his acoustic set down in Mexico in May, and it just blew the doors off. And then after that, we're gonna have a really special mountain jam, which is a bunch of artists coming together to form a super group and do a lot of music. And so Patrick Hallahan of My Morning Jacket, Eric Krasno, Nikki Bloom, a lot of people will be in that mountain jam. And then Saturday night is Aiko and Dumpsta Funk. So that night we will have Stephanie Izar do a New Orleans-based dinner, and then we will second line up to the Marquee like we did last year and listen to some really good music.
Okay. I had a caller, a listener call in asking how can local artists get involved with that Summit Rising? It's too late for this year.
Yeah, it's too late for this year. So this year we made an application, and this being the second year, this was the first year we actually had an application process. So so next year it'll be the same thing. We'll have an application process, and that'll go out probably sometime. When did we put that application up? I think
early June.
Early June, yeah. And it's, you know, a pretty basic form with just asking for a good deal of assets. And this year we have a little more than a third of our artists are local artists. So we're trying to have a good local presence there, because there is a huge scene in Salt Lake and Park City.
And we do try to really curate the group, because we want diversity of music, diversity of genre, diversity in everything, so that they can build community and learn from each other. So we try to pull from different areas, but definitely with a focus on local.
Yeah.
All right, so any plans then to expand Summit Rising? Or is it, you know, to maybe a year-round program?
Yeah, I mean, I think the ideal is, like, we'd like to figure out more ways to provide year-round resources and mentorship especially for all the people who come through the program and then go off to do something else. Like, we have one artist this year who's a returning from last year. I'd like to figure out how to build out the program in a way to where we could really have year-round just resources for all these people who come through.
And we're working on having master classes throughout the year that they can participate in. And so that is part of how we want to expand the program.
Sure. And Paige, the Song Summit was denied funding. I think it was the Restaurant of the Cultural Tax Grant. Are there plans then to kind of rewrite the grant so that you can secure funding going forward? I didn't really understand why it was denied.
You just asked an excellent question, Leslie. You know, we have applied for a lot of local grants from Summit County, and it is actually quite surprising we've been denied in all cases. And I don't understand that either. So we're trying to learn from that. But, you know, it is hard when you don't get local funding for something that, to the people that attend it, it has such an impact. We hear constantly, this has really helped me in my wellness journey, or I got sober because of what you're doing. And so you see that true impact, and that's really what keeps us going, but not having local support is very challenging for us. And so, not surprisingly, you start to doubt what am I doing wrong, or why aren't we being supported? And so we are trying to figure that out, and we're working with local, officials to figure out why we keep getting denied funding, but we don't have the answers yet.
Yeah. Well, I can see for the restaurant tax because, right? I mean, drinking's not part of it, right? That's something you're trying to get away from, but with the
also,
cultural aspect.
Yeah, but part of it is we want people to feel inclusive. If you drink, great. We're having offset beer in Song Summit Village. If you don't drink, we're having great mocktails or matcha or, Lucky Ones is going to do a signature coffee for us. So we want to make it inclusive for those that drink or don't, because music, even for the people in the audience, you go to music and, back to your sex, drugs, and rock and roll, both artists and audience alike. And those that are sober but like music, they want to feel included. And they don't want just Diet Coke and water. And so it's all about that. We don't shun those that drink. We just want to make it inclusive for everyone.
Okay. People can get a lot more information online?
Yes. At ParkCitySongSummit.com. And the foundation has a tab on that webpage, or you can go to SongSummitFoundation.org.
Okay. Forward or Paige, anything else you wanted to mention?
I think that's it.
Thank you so much for having us, Leslie.
You bet. Again, I've been talking with Ford Huntington and Paige Anderson with the Song Summit Foundation. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. Well, the Utah Main Street program has officially expanded its statewide footprint with 7 new downtowns selected to join its network. On the phone with details, I have the manager and statewide coordinator of the program, Chelsea Gauthier, along with the director of the Historic Park City Alliance, Ginger Wicks. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning, Leslie. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, so Chelsea, start by telling us what the Utah Main Street program is and what the mission is of this organization.
Sure. So the Utah Main Street Program, we're a preservation-based economic revitalization program, and we're housed within the State Historic Preservation Office in the Department of Cultural and Community Engagement. So we're really a network of community members across the state, both rural and urban, really engaging in historic commercial district revitalization. We're looking at strengthening our communities, like at the heart of them. We're looking at a commitment to community-led efforts and really showing what the heart of our unique places are. Our network has 29 communities in it now, and we offer downtown leaders across the state with technical support, sometimes some grant opportunities, and shared learning for ongoing downtown journeys.
Okay, so 29 communities. It sounds like you got a lot to grow on here.
Yes, we're really excited, especially with having Park City and Midway joining these efforts. We've already had Heber as a part of our program, so we're excited to have a strong Wasatch back in the network.
Okay, so are you part of this Main Street America model?
Yes. Thank you for bringing that up. We are the statewide coordinating program officially recognized by the national nonprofit Main Street America. And Main Street America is one of a subsidiary of the National Trust for Historic Preservation. So we're one of over 45 statewide coordinating programs doing this work with over 1,200 communities statewide or across the nation.
All right. So for a community to join the network, it's a fee or, what does it take?
Yeah, no, it's really just that commitment to local revitalization, the willingness to wanting to have a community-led approach and to celebrate your historic places. We offer The opportunity to apply to the program once a year, typically in the spring. And we look for, you know, some sort of historic downtown fabric or a historic commercial core that's maybe in a neighborhood if you're in a larger community. And really just you're free to join once they've applied and you are accepted into our program. And we're here to support local efforts.
Yeah. So what do communities have to demonstrate before they're accepted into the network?
Yes, we're just really looking at, one, the eagerness to have a community-led approach. We're looking at a commitment towards revitalization and wanting to build local leadership and organizational capacity. We're looking at creating that organizational structure, having strategy-driven programming, and having the willingness to piece together all the projects and connecting them to your downtown plans to have that preservation-based economic development. So we work with communities then to help demonstrate their impact and results to share their story of who they are.
Okay. As you mentioned, you have expanded. This year, 7 new communities, including Park City and Midway, joined the network. So maybe explain why a community would want to participate.
Sure. Well, we're applying the Main Street America 4-point approach. So we're looking at, building the capacity and leadership of a Main Street director and volunteer network that's in your community. You're looking at economic vitality, so we're strengthening your local economy. And this pillar really is centering on making your downtown, business friendly, filling vacant spaces, driving private investment, and really that spirit of local entrepreneurship, as well as your legacy businesses. So it's helping to strengthen those networks. We're also looking at design, which is really, your physical identity. So we're preserving our character, we're enhancing your spaces. We're looking at, potential physical improvements that can make, downtown safe, attractive, and visually distinct. And you're also promoting. We work with the communities to promote branding and district activation. So they're learning strategies that will drive foot traffic, really creating that sense of place and how each downtown is different from one another, and really celebrating district pride and giving residents also reasons to visit repeatedly, really going to those third places.
So Park City already has a nationally recognized historic district. So Ginger, what value does this Main Street designation bring to a community that already attracts visitors from around the world?
Well, you're right. I mean, the historic Park City is probably ahead of maybe some of the other communities that are joining the association and participating. But we feel like there's a lot that we can learn to continue to grow the historic district in terms of, locals coming back to the street as we work collaboratively with the city on the Main Street area plan, some strategies to work through that. But one of the big things that we saw would be appealing for our members is once we advance to tier 2, there is a lot of grant funding and opportunities that would become available for our members to participate in. So we thought that was really appealing. We worked with the city on our application to apply to be a part of the association. So it is a collaboration between the AHPCA and the city with this membership. Because, as you know, the city owns most of Main Street, and so we do definitely need to make sure that we're working together as we continue to improve Main Street and look forward to, the 2034 games specifically. So,
yeah. So, in practical terms, I guess, what does membership mean in terms of Park City's businesses and property owners?
Well, I mean, what it would mean for them is it's going to open doors to a lot of resources for them that they would not have otherwise. So I think that would be appealing for our members.
Yeah. And as you mentioned, the ongoing Main Street area planning that's being done, how does this membership complement that city's ongoing efforts with those planning efforts?
Well, we're still trying to understand what the Main Street area plan, what points of that plan the council and the community want to focus on. But I think the tools and the resources that this association offers to the HPCA and our board can help us navigate through those planning discussions. I think it can help us learn how to better engage the street in making sure that we're capturing what the businesses on Main Street want as we work through the Main Street area plan. So there's a lot of educational resources that they offer. So I think those things could be helpful as we move through that process.
And now, Chelsea, Midway has a very different character from Park City. So how does this Main Street model adapt to communities with different histories, sizes, economies?
Sure. So applying that four-point approach that I mentioned earlier, it's not a cookie-cutter model. It's really we work with the community to create, to select a transformation strategy, to look at data that's already there, and then create a work plan for the next, 1 to 3 years of how you're going to apply these efforts for your downtown activation. So it's not a one size, everyone's doing exactly the same thing. We recognize local heritage, local identity, and we're working with the community with their voices of what they're wanting to enhance.
Okay. Let's see. I guess, as you mentioned, that four-prong approach of organization, I believe, promotion, design, and economic viability, what are the expectations then for this tier one over the next year or two?
So we have a three-tiered approach for our program. Tier one is you're just getting started with the Utah Main Street journey. Like you said, Park City and Midway all have very distinct downtowns. And then as they're progressing through our tier two, we have technical assistance that will apply. We have a preservation architect on staff who is there to meet with property owners when requested for, assessing historic buildings. We're really helping work through reinvestment stats. Communities will be collecting stats, looking at, how many vacant properties are there? What are the opportunities for, revitalizing upper floor housing or downtown commercial spaces? They're looking at employment records. We're looking at maybe appropriate infill development within a historic district, things of that nature.
All right. Ginger, do you think any residents will notice any changes as a result of joining the network? Or, is a lot of this just being done behind the scenes?
They may notice some different activations that we may try to implement as we learn from what maybe other communities are doing. For me right now, I think, or the HPCA rather, we're wanting to better engage with businesses on the street, for the Main Street area plan, for all things that affect businesses on the street. And so I'm hoping to learn from what other communities do to get engaged. So initially they may not. It might just be all behind the scenes.
Okay. All right. Well, Chelsea or Ginger, anything else you wanted to tell us about the program or what we can look forward to?
I don't have anything further to add. I just am looking forward to learning from what other communities are doing.
I will add that in 2025, we, as we collect these national statistics, Main Street America was able to show that on average, for every dollar that's being spent within a Main Street program operations, there was a $23.13 return reinvested into that downtown district, which is a huge impact. So it shows that investing in these community-led movements to apply, downtown plans, to work with local business owners and property owners and the community at large really does work.
Yeah, sounds like a great return. Okay, Chelsea Gauthier and Ginger Wicks, thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thanks so much.
Park City resident Jen Drummond has successfully completed her second world record by climbing both the tallest and the second tallest mountains on each continent. She completed the feat last month by finishing the climb up Denali with one of her five sons, Jacob Hokanson. Both of them join me now in studio. Good morning. Thanks for being here.
Good morning.
And congratulations, Jen. So maybe, of course, for listeners who may not have been following along, give us kind of the Reader's Digest digest version of your two records. It started with 7 second summits and then moved on to
Yes.
Seven summits.
7 seconds. Finished those and realized I had 3 mountains left to be the first and only woman to climb the highest and the second highest points. And the fun thing about the 3 that were left, 2 of them could be summited with some of my children. So I said, okay, let's do this. So May and June of this year have been really busy. We went to Mont Blanc. Jacob and Joe and Jonathan summited that with me. I flew to Russia, grabbed one real quick there, Elbrus, and then came home. Joe graduated from high school, and Jacob and I headed up to Denali with 3 other characters and had a great experience.
So I guess, what does that accomplishment mean to you, completing both?
You know, for me, it gave me a platform to help other people stop postponing life and live your some days list, which we all have. So being able to have that credibility now puts me in position to encourage others to chase whatever their Denali or world record is.
Yeah. What kind of publicity are you getting on this? Because I mean, I'm not an early morning TV person, of course, but are you?
I mean, I've been on the Jennifer Hudson show. I've been on Today Show, Good Morning America, a lot of the big stuff. And so it's just fun being places and being exposed to different people and different ideas.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, I guess let's talk a little bit about just the challenges themselves. When you kind of look back, you've had some time to do that. What mountain proved to be the most technically difficult for you?
Technically difficult actually was Dik Tau in Russia. And the reason why is because you're tied to each other. There's no fixed lines on the mountain. So when there's a fixed line on the mountain, you can kind of lean onto that rope and trust it. When there's not, I'm leaning on you or you're leaning on me. If either one of us make a mistake, we're both paying the consequences. And on that mountain, you get a lot of snow because of where it's positioned in between two seas. You have rock climbing, you have ice climbing where you're using 2 ice axes and toe picks, and then you have just regular every pieces of it, like all of it.
Yeah, what was the most mentally challenging for you?
Denali was the most mentally challenging. And because I self-guided that. So all the other expeditions up to this point, I had hired a guide in that area. And I wanted to just go out with this last one, being the highest point in North America, being our home base mountain, and give it a shot. And so this one just carried a different level of mental strain.
Given that you were in charge?
I was in charge, and I had my son. Mm-hmm. And the week before we went, there was 5 deaths on the mountain. And so then that brought it really home and real fast. And we went to the mountain. You can have a team. We signed up for a team of 6. Somebody got sick kind of right before we left. So then we had a team of 5, and you can't add to your permit that late. And when we landed on the glacier, we had 650 pounds for 5 people. And it was just like, how many things can go against us? But I kept coming back to one step at a time. Let's see what unfolds. And whatever happens, we're giving it an effort.
Yeah, so how long did it take from, you know?
Yeah, we got lucky. So we planned for 28 days, and we did it in 13. Wow. So the weather cooperated, the team was feeling strong, things went better than planned.
Well, Jacob, since we last talked, you said you wanted to be there with your mom when she finished on this goal. Why was that important to you?
I think that was really important for me, just so I could see, like, firsthand that, like, we can do hard things, I guess. And I think that, obviously, that was like a huge milestone for my mom. She's been working at it for like years and years. So I think it was just really important for like me to be there to support her as much as I would want her to be there for me if I was in a position like that.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit now. So do you now have the climbing bug too?
I kind of have the climbing bug, I would say, a little bit. I mean, we're going back to Kilimanjaro today, but you know, we're just, I don't know, I'm kind of here for the ride this summer, really. And yeah, I would say I have a little bit of a climbing bug, but nothing like crazy. I don't think I'll ever go do like the big mountains over in Nepal or anything. But.
So how was Denali different from your climb on Mont Blanc?
I would say Denali was definitely a completely different experience. I mean, first off, we weren't skiing. We're carrying all of our own stuff. We're there for 2 weeks instead of just like Mont Blanc was like one day up and down the whole thing. And also you're just dealing with a whole different environment. When you're in the Arctic Circle, temperatures just like drastically change really fast. Sun never sets. But yeah, I would say overall it was just much more challenging and physically, mentally, all like in every way.
Yeah, I mean, Joe had a lot going on, but he was like, man, it's too cold. Was it cold?
Oh, yeah, it was cold. I mean, when we were at 17K camp, at nighttime, it would get around negative 22. And at the top, when we summited, I think it was around negative 30.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's not me. I'm with Joe. So did you need oxygen on Denali?
No. Yeah, no oxygen for that one, fortunately.
Yeah. I guess what surprised you most about kind of the physical and mental challenges of the expedition?
I think that, I mean, physically, obviously, it's a lot of weight. About everyone was carrying their own body weight or more, you know, for hours at a time uphill in snow. So you're just dealing with all sorts of variables, like the friction on the snow with your sled and all that stuff. But, yeah.
Yeah. So I guess as her son, I mean, what was it like watching your mom finish this world record achievement?
I would say it definitely opened up my eyes and, you know, being able to, I see how strong my mom is, and I already knew that she was a really strong person. But I mean, if you told me now that my mom said that was the most mentally challenging mountain, I would not guess that at all. She's good at hiding that for sure. But I think, yeah, overall, I think, yeah.
Yeah, what did you learn about your mom?
I learned that my mom doesn't quit no matter what. My mom gets what she wants if she really wants it. And she's really good at, like, you know, adjusting the situations fast, especially in environments like that where you're constantly dealing with weather change and all that stuff. She's definitely quick to adapt and, like, you know, be in the best position possible.
And Jen, what did you learn about your son?
Oh, you know, it's so fun doing these adventures with your children because you watch them hit struggle and you get to hold that space and you get to see how they navigate it. And so watching Jacob get into a spot, in the beginning, I wouldn't let him listen to music because I wanted him to listen to the environment and hear how different snow sounds and different things. And then when it was time for the summit push, there was a spot that he was really struggling and he's like, hey, can I listen to music? I said, yes. And he put on that music and it just shifted everything for him and he locked into another gear and got it done. And so watching your kid struggle, but then also find a solution. And then when we're coming down the mountain, he goes, Mom, it's so crazy. My brain told me I was done. Every single step I took, my body kept taking the steps. So obviously my brain was lying to me. And I'm like, it does those things. So just fun to be able to experience that stuff firsthand and be there for it.
Yeah, and Jacob, I've asked your mom several times along these years how she could do such dangerous stuff and leave 7 kids at home. I mean, what do you and your siblings have to say this? I mean, was it something that was stressful for you guys when she would leave? Especially knowing now what you know about what it's like out there.
I think that, yeah, for sure, it was definitely stressful somewhat as a kid. But at the same time, when you're watching your mom, like, chase her own dreams and show you that, like, you can do hard things and you can do, like, really whatever you want if you really put the time and, like, effort into it. So I think overall, like, we all knew that our mom was doing this for us. And that was, like, really important. And I think that that played, like, a huge role in my childhood. Because, I mean, now, I mean, I got to one-up my mom now, you know? And, like, I can't be the slacker in the back that, like, watch my mom do all these hard things and I'm just, like, the lazy guy. Like, now, you know, I have, like, our whole family has, like, a different, like, level of standard now. And I think that that was really, really important. And I think that's going to, I mean, benefit all of us in the future.
Yeah. Jen, you've often spoken about kind of pushing beyond, you know, perceived limits. How has mountaineering influenced your approach now just to everyday life?
You know, I think the thing is you can predict and you can plan and then things show up, right? And so that doesn't mean you don't predict. It doesn't mean you don't plan. But that planning and predicting gives you the bandwidth to adjust to what happens. And whether that's on the mountain or somebody's sick from school or a business decision doesn't go the way that you want, you just have to keep showing up and keep doing you and keep following your North Star. And whatever comes your way, it's coming your way because you're prepared to handle it.
Yeah. So, I mean, what's next after this extraordinary goal? I mean, what other adventures are out there for you?
Yeah, so we kind of talked about this as a family. We have a list called some days, right? Like, someday I want to go taste pasta in Italy, or someday I want to go do this different thing. And the thing with mountaineering, it was so extreme that I really couldn't take a lot of people that I enjoyed on those activities. And so now we're really focusing on what's everybody's someday and what things can we do together that build those memories and keep the stories going.
Yeah, what would you like to see on that? What's on your list there, Jacob?
I mean, Denali was definitely there for me, but I think that the next thing is, you know, chilling on the beach in Mykonos. That's my next goal. I mean.
And you mentioned you're off to Kilimanjaro tonight to what, climb it as a family or?
Yeah, so I've done Kilimanjaro before when I was a freshman in high school, so I was 14 years old. Now I'm 17. But I did that with my two older brothers, and all my younger siblings were just a little too young. And now I'm going back to just have that experience with my younger siblings as well. And also, just, I like being in environments with my mom a lot, if I'm being honest. The energy is always there. But I think, yeah, I'm going to go back down and do that just to have that experience with them and, you know, kind of show them that, you know, we could do hard things.
Yeah, so how young is the youngest?
So the twins are going to go. So the twins are going to be 13. So that's pretty young. But Jacob going gives a chance for him to lead a lot of his siblings. And then I'm going to go. We have some friends going as adults. And we're going to hit a little safari afterwards and then come home.
Yeah, what route are you climbing up?
We're going the Machame route, and we're going to do it in 6 days, we hope. We have 7 as a backup plan, but with everybody pretty much coming from altitude, it feels pretty good.
So it is, what, springtime? Coming up on springtime out of winter?
Yeah, we're just getting out of that. So, yep. And then right now the animals are moving on the Serengeti, and so we're kind of excited to have that experience.
Well, yeah, now it's like, it's kind of over. I feel so like, oh my gosh, it's over, but hopefully we can follow you along on something else.
We're gonna do some other fun things. Our goal is to help everybody that has a someday live that out this year. And we've done a few of them with different people that we randomly met. And so our goal is to meet 365 people and have a memory with somebody that's trying to do their someday over the next few years.
Okay. Well, again, congratulations and great job there, Jacob, as well.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. Well, Bear Canyon, a proposed town in Wasatch County near Sundance, can't go forward because it didn't meet all of the state's requirements. KPCW's Grace Dorfler reports it's not yet clear whether another application will be accepted in its stead.
Bear Canyon was one of two preliminary municipality proposals the Utah Lieutenant Governor's Office accepted in January. Its application was part of a program that allows a small group of landowners to begin creating a town on mostly undeveloped land. Now, the Lieutenant Governor says the would-be developers' plans fell short, so they can't move forward. Wasatch County Manager Dustin Graybaugh said Tuesday he's glad to hear the news.
This is some exciting news.
Layla Basic, an office administrator for the Lieutenant Governor's office, confirmed the certification of Bear Canyon's request for feasibility study was rescinded July 16th. The Utah Population Committee found that although a strip of land connects two areas in the proposed town, it's too narrow to be considered contiguous. This is the second rejection for Bear Canyon, whose landowners wanted to build a resort community of about 1,000 residential units near the Utah County border. The project's first request for a feasibility study was denied in February because too many property owners were included in the proposed town boundaries. State law says sponsors cannot modify their request for a feasibility study more than once, so this is the end of the line for Bear Canyon for this year. The landowners could reapply in January 2027. The Lieutenant Governor's office made its decision a day after Walsburg residents met to mobilize against preliminary municipalities. Residents are concerned about the prospect of major development in their backyard. Graybaugh says county leaders are concerned too.
We'll be bringing back to the council in August as a resolution encouraging the state to repeal this law and stop the pilot program.
State law established the preliminary municipality pilot program in 2024. The Lieutenant Governor's office can accept 2 applications each year until 2031. It's not yet clear whether the state can or will accept another application instead of Bear Canyon. The Lieutenant Governor's office told KPCW it is, quote, evaluating next steps. Supporters say the program is needed to help address Utah's housing shortage, but Graybaugh rejects that reasoning.
That's the justification that is being given for why we need several hundred more homes that are very high end so that we can get maybe a small handful of arguably affordable units. I just don't think that that's a reality. I think we would be better served by more specific targeting on affordable housing issues than just this type of broad brush development incentive.
He says he'd like the county to ride the wave of the Stratos data center's unpopularity to convince state leaders to walk back the preliminary municipality program. This year's other accepted application, Wasatch Highlands, is also in Wasatch County, east of Heber. A population committee found Wasatch Highlands would have about 2,200 residents when complete. Meanwhile, Moab area residents are suing developers and the Lieutenant Governor's office, arguing preliminary municipalities are unconstitutional. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.